Those who are object to the analysis of such paradoxes as mere word quibbling do not understand the important role played by words in secretly constructing our thought, nor do they comprehend that semantic problems are really logical ones, and quite often they are even epistemological ones. And they do not understand that the meaning of a thing is inseparable from what we ourselves think it to be, it is not only what some dictionary prints concerning it. And they do not understand that the hidden working of the mind in the viewing of the world is something quite other than they usually suppose it to be. Relativity shows at least that we have got to alter our inherited habits of thinking about the world. Space and time demand lamination because they enter into every conception of the external world. They are the forms in which our experience is given us. A complete understanding of this world completely involves them too. Our objective life on Earth obviously moves within the conditions imposed upon it by space and time. All our experience is indeed inseparable from them. All measurable bodies and all living creatures are presented to our senses as existing spatially or temporally, and we cannot help representing the entire universe to ourselves within a specific frame of space and time. We cannot think of the myriad facts and manifold events of nature without thinking of them as filling a position somewhere in space and somewhere in time. But the meaning of the latter is always relative and changes with changing circumstances. Therefore, these phenomena of nature can themselves only be thought of relatively. If we change our frame, we shall change familiar characteristics of our universe too. It will lose its fundamental fixity, its unalterable absoluteness. There can be no such thing as unique spatial relation or unchangeable time observation. When we look more deeply into space, it tends to change its character from what appears to be an outward fact to what is really an inward mental factor. We must, in short, begin to mentalize space and spatialize mind. So far from being a property of the external world, space begins to appear as a mysterious subjective element which conditions our perception of the entire external world. But this view abandons the old conceptions of physics. It is in line with Einstein's mathematical deductions which have made the mass of a body variable. The old idea of matter was that its most prominent and most tangible characteristic, technically termed mass, was also its most enduring one. This is true of the low rates of movement of everyday objects, but it is no longer true of those beyond ordinary experience where extremely high rates of movement prevail, for Einstein has forced science to discard the old belief inasmuch as he has proved that the mass of matter may vary. Thus physical objects become transformed into fields of electrical force, of pure energy assuming forms dictated by velocity. The belief in a separate something, a solid material substance, has been seriously affected. Hitherto we could not speak of matter apart from the space it occupied, whereas we can speak of energy with far less need to put it into space. This new notion that energy has mass and that the mass of a material body can change proportionately above certain rates of movement renders the material character of a thing no longer its cardinal one. The imagination cannot here easily catch up with reason, but that must not be taken as an excuse for allowing the former to obstruct the latter. The new scientific view must necessarily offend common sense in thus destroying the static nature of an object. It is impossible for the mind to present to itself in any adequate imagery the idea of how relativity strangely affects the mass of our material universe. We must be content to know, without knowing how, the tricks of time. The strange light which relativity has thrown on our beliefs about space is quite similar to that which it has cast on our beliefs about time. Our confidence in dating a single event is shattered when we learn that it will be seen at different times by two observers who are placed on bodies with different rates of apostrophe movement. We start in surprise on hearing that two occurrences which are simultaneous in occurrence for one witness will appear to have a lapse of duration between them for the other. The Earth does not spin so fast through space as it did during the earlier days of its hot youth, and consequently the length of our day is more than double what it then was. Such is the relativity of time that the slow turtle which lives for a century may not feel that it has endured more than the swift insect which appears, grows, mates and dies in a single week, for it determines its experience from a different standpoint. The point is how many sensations pass through the mind. If the number is equal in both cases, then years do not count. Whoever has experimented with certain drugs knows that one consequence will be the unfoldment of an abnormal sense of time, so that a simple act like lifting a hand will vividly take a half hour to perform in consciousness, yet to a watching person it is but the deed of a moment. Some who have escaped death from drowning by a hair's breadth report that during the brief period preceding unconsciousness the history of their life flashed like lightning before their mind's eye. We fall asleep only apparently to awake again soon after in dream, but we know later that we actually awoke only next morning. We feel as much awake during dream as during the day, yet in 5 minutes of dream time we complete a journey that takes 3 the revelation of relativity weeks of waking time. We live in dream through a long sequence of dramatic events, often highly detailed, and hours or days seem to have passed in the experience. But inquiry reveals that the whole series of events has occupied only a fraction of a minute. Thus experience reveals the strange fluctuations of our sense of time when we approach the same fact from different points of view. A man differently situated, say on the planet of Venus, would necessarily have a different time sense from ours. The notion that 24 hours will be 24 hours always under all conditions and in all places is not correct. Such a disclaimer may give a deep shock to our most familiar habits of thought. Yet consider the case of a young man who has spent 3 or 4 hours with an ardently loved sweetheart. The period will seem to him to be shortened to less than a single hour. Consider as contrast the case of an invalid who has accidentally fallen on a hot stove, and is unable to lift himself up quickly. To him each intensified second will seem as long as an hour. Each man has his individual time perception, as such abnormal instances make clear, and it is illusory to believe that it is any other than his own unique experience. He sees events in the perspective of his own special standpoint, because time itself is only a relation. We never really measure time itself. Even clock time is only a measurement of a motion in space, that is a relation between two things. We are compelled by nature to see everything as existent in space and time. Time is immutably presupposed in the thinking process. Space is a necessary condition of the perceiving process. We can never separate a single thing from them, yet we never see space and time themselves. We get no direct sense impression of pure space or pure time. We cannot clothe the bare idea of space in any mental image. We can only think of a thing occupying distance, extension. Hence we know space only as a property of things and time as a property of movement. The ordinary way is to regard time as being like a flowing stream or like a constant succession of ticked-off moments. This is perfectly natural, for the human mind cannot even imagine a time which is devoid of the passage of happenings or in which no before, now and after of events exist. It is in time that one thought follows another as it is in time that events occur. Can you form any idea of time at all unless you conceive it in beginnings and endings or with breaks and changes? But unfortunately this leads us into an illusion. For we suppose time to be divided into moments, but try to get precise hold of them and they vanish. Analysis discovers no separate parts, no independent moments, there is no interval between present and past. How can anyone distinguish when the present moment begins or when it ends? Try to find the recognizable point of separation between the past and the future, between before and after. Whatever you take as such a point will no longer remain such the moment you have distinguished it. Yet what is the present moment except such a hypothetical point? It is one of the illusions of time that we perpetually believe ourselves to be living in the events of the present time when no such division really exists. Whether it be a single second or 1/1000th of a second or 1/1000000th of a second later, the so-called present moment will already have lapsed into the so-called past. Our glib talk of the present, past and future phases of time is talk of something which nobody can determine and of which nobody can form an appreciable idea that will be correct enough to defy all analysis. What then becomes of our whole notion of time when no notion can be formed of its separate constituents? Thus what seemed to be a reality seems more likely to be to some extent at least an idea harbored by our minds, that is, the movement of time is largely within ourselves. Observe anything that grows, a grass seed for example. Can you state at what precise moment the seed becomes a plant? This is quite impossible. Then where is that moment when the seed was no longer a seed but a plant? If it exists anywhere, it must be in your mind or imagination. Thus the time changes are really your own experiences. Moments do not really exist. Time is not an addition of non-existences. Add naught to naught and the total sum is still naught. Therefore time is not an independent reality but an abstraction which is made from reality. Time, like space, is an abstraction. But when an abstraction is taken to be something real, it contradicts itself. When we push our reasoning still farther, we have to admit that our sense of time may contract just as our sense of space may enlarge, and that when we measure the flight of time, the mind somehow and to some degree creates it. Relativity teaches that the forms which time takes in experience are never final. They are aspects which may alter in the wildest manner. Yet there is one inseparable element which persists through all their alterations and which unifies and holds them all. And that is the factor of mind. All this shows that time is not the simple thing we take it to be but is actually pregnant with mystery. Mankind perishes speedily by thinking time real. The little time I spend in asking, "Is there the revelation of relativity time at all?" has revealed to me the perfect peace. The very deity himself / was the observation of Tirumulai, a medieval writer in the Tamil language. And still more sagely he asked the question, "Do you not know that time vanishes when its origin is sought for? What then is the use of limiting yourself to it?" It would be a great error to imagine that any attempt is being made to deny that man has any sense of time. Nothing of the kind need be denied. He certainly feels the passage of time and feels its reality strongly. The attempt made here is to cast a little light upon its nature. The hidden source of this feeling of its reality will become apparent as this course unfolds. The doctrine of standpoints. The value of Einstein's work in proving the truth of relativity by physical facts instead of metaphysical fancies is immense. What he has unconsciously achieved has been a critique of knowledge, albeit he has limited his inquiry to scientific methods of measurement. The entire principle of relativity raises a gigantic question mark against all our experience of the universe and hence against all our definitions of knowledge. What do we really know? The world is no longer a hard fact but a harder problem. Relativity is a fundamental law which underlies all physical events, all objects in nature. Nothing is known that is not known in relation to other things. Hence the saying of Lot, that to exist is to stand in relation. The idea that there are any closed systems in the universe disappears under the searching light of relativity. Each is only a tentative stage in the approach to truth and never the final step. The universe requires constant reinterpretation. There may be as many relative truths in the physical world as there are possible positions or ways of looking at a thing. This is the anthropocentric flaw which vitiates ordinary knowledge. There may be as many views of truth in the world of thought as there are human beings. Such pluralistic and protean views are dependent on human limitations and are therefore always conditional and often liable to alter. Each is but an aspect, none is the entire truth. The mid-Victorian materialism, for instance, is now refuted by several leading scientists as vigorously as their predecessors had maintained it. Here is Myhrad's signal of warning. An observation may be quite true when it is the consequence of fixing our attention on any particular point of view in the realm where relativity reigns, and yet it may not be the truth in itself. The two are different. All these factors are to be looked upon as men's individual and incomplete views because they are dependent on the flexibility of human taste, the kinds of human temperament, the grades of human knowledge or the degrees of its capacity. This is why we see such wide differences of opinion, such strange conflict of experience, and so many varieties of belief, outlook, custom and conclusion. Therefore these departments are called relative truths. So wide is the possible range of the individual views arising out of such dependence on relative truth that there can be no limit to their number. Each department, like biology or pharmacology, for instance, possesses its own particular view of life or deals with some fragment of it, but none possesses a view which is common to all, just as none deals with the totality of existence. When the apparition of relativity appeared on the threshold of science, it frightened the timid. Well might they fear to push its logical consequence to its farthest end. This they still hesitate to do, so philosophy must take up the task for them. From its lofty standpoint, which, it must be pointed out, is that of ultimate truth and not of practical value, all non-philosophic knowledge, whether scientific or otherwise, stands on treacherous territory. None of its conclusions are or can ever be final. All depend on the parochial standpoint of observers on our insignificant planet, a mere speck among millions of other stars in space. All its results may be modified when with additional knowledge further standpoints become available. It may hope to discover distortions of the final reality by its present methods, but never reality itself. It moves ever from one provisional tenet to another like a restless ever-wandering Jew. We may therefore well become bewildered as to the nature of the perplexing world in which we live. It is as paradoxical as any that could be conceived. It is a world where reason does violence to experience and where fact offers denial to thought. All human intellectual knowledge suffers from being entirely relative and in the end is chasing its own tail. It travels in a circle from which escape seems impossible. It would seem that we can never get at the final truth of the universe, and that we are captives perpetually doomed to receive only the illusion of fresher knowledge but never the knowledge itself. Truth has become a myth. Finality is a fiction. It merely means, one out of countless possible views, every outlook may thus receive its justification. No scientific observation may now be declared correct for all time and for all observation. No scientific theory exists but is incurably tainted with this all-pervasive the revelation of relativity-relativism. These different and divergent appearances of one and the same thing when the observers or standpoints are themselves different may well make us despair at ever knowing what is the truth about the world. For men will constantly change their intellectual position and shift to newer notions, only to lose them again next time. Everything thus becomes in the last analysis either a fleeting appearance or an insignificant illusion. Nothing may make pretension to finality. It means that we get only fragmentary views of the world and never see the world as a whole. It means that we get only an endless supersession of one doctrine by another. It means that the mind forever displaces one set of ideas by another. It means that the fact itself depends on the standpoint from which we approach it. What is appropriate to one standpoint will not suit another. For we get at aspects, not at independent entities. The sight of one aspect excludes all the others. There is no finality in metaphysics also because it equally with science is afflicted by the stubborn and persistent malady of relativity. The attempt to attain an irrevocable system of explanation has proved futile. In short, the picture of the world which we possess or which science possesses is not the final one. In this world of relativism where all views are both false and true, where what can be affirmed from one standpoint can also be denied from another, there seems to be no final meaning. Those Indian seekers who perceived the inevitability of this consequence became dissatisfied. They wanted to know whether it is possible to arrive at a view which would explain all the facts and not only some of them. So the cardinal question again forced itself upon them. They sought an answer, like Pontius Pilate, to their supreme query, what is truth? Can we get at the last word of truth in its integrity? By this they meant something that was not so imperfect, that was no less universally valid for all men as that the addition of 1 + 2 results in 3. Nobody in any part of the world or in any century has yet questioned this arithmetical result. Such an unvarying principle of truth was sought by them. This they called the ultimate truth. Finally they found a satisfactory answer and then the hidden teaching was formulated. They proved that it was all a matter of standpoint, of climbing sufficiently high until the summit of all possible peaks was reached. They urged that the failure to find any absolute characteristic in the materials of our knowledge of the universe need not frighten us into despair. It should stimulate us to listen to the voice of the hidden philosophy, which explicitly says that a fresh approach to the problem should be sought for and may be found. Euclid showed that parallel lines never meet, Einstein showed that they may. Yet both may be considered as right provided we remember that they differ according to the different standpoints taken. The inhabitant of another planet using a watch marked in exactly the same manner as our watches would apparently measure time in the same way, but actually the similarity would be fictitious. His day might be longer or shorter than ours, therefore his 3 o'clock might not be equivalent to ours. For the standards of spatial reference would be different and the time systems would necessarily differ too. The difference of standpoint will always be fatal to uniformity of observation. The appearance of what the Earthman sees cannot be separated from his own position in space. The shape of a thing, the position it occupies and the place in time and space which it possesses are after all appearances presented differently to different observers. This is the implication of Einstein's general theory of relativity. The need of taking fresh standpoints to secure expanded outlooks is thus an essential and important lesson of relativity. The relativity principle does not put Newton in the wrong nor make it necessary to discard old measurements. It draws a line of limitation around every kind of result and within each such system of reference the old measurements and the Newtonian notions hold good. It shows that we must not expect them to be always applicable, because they are only relative to a particular standpoint. One standpoint which is higher than another will reveal a wider horizon. Even the slowest experience of life shows that many things are not what they seem at first sight, that the naive immediate impressions of them prove to be insufficient when we move to a deeper inquiry into them. It is Pound's first lesson of philosophy and the last lesson of experience. It is the difference between what actually is and what only appears to be, between what is substantial and what seems to be substantial. We meet this contradiction of experience everywhere. It is to be found in human society as well as in planetary processes. The course, size and distance of a starry body do not yield to the gaze, look at it as long as we will. We must put forth intellectual effort, take instruction from astronomy, and then only can we wrest its secret from the seen. If everything revealed its whole nature to first uncorrected impression, science would never be needed and philosophy would never have to fatigue itself by following on the heels of science. The revelation of relativity, the wide discrepancy between experience and the truth of experience, compels us to press onward beyond the plausible fact to challenging reflection upon the fact. To stick always to a single position and take things from that position only because it is troublesome to find a fresh one or because everybody else sticks to that position is ultimately unsafe and philosophically unwise. From what point of view are we seeking truth? On what point of vantage do we stand when gazing at what we deem truth? For all that will determine both what we see and how far what we see is true. The meaning of what we believe to be truth and the value of a judgment are entirely conditioned by the standpoint we take up. Thus, the possibility of ascertaining more truth in the scientific sphere increases by the mere upward shifting of standpoint. Philosophy absorbs this lesson and then carries it still further, for it says, "Let us therefore rise to the highest possible, the ultimate standpoint, where there is no relativity, and make our final conclusions about the world only then." It points out that we cannot escape from the need of a double viewpoint, the first being inclusive of all possible and relative positions embraced by ordinary practical life and experimental science, the second being the remote, austere and unique one of purely universal reason free from all relativity. For the view which will be obtained from the latter will be absolutely independent of those personal human characteristics which render all results partial and relative. They may be most useful for immediate and practical purposes, but they cannot serve the more exacting quest of final truth. A mind that tires easily will, at the sight of unaccustomed paths, be content with the first and most immediate standpoint, that of practical utility, taking things just as they are perceived by the senses, whereas one that is well imbued with the love of truth will exert itself to rise above first appearances or the homely surface of things and reach their explanation by taking up a critical and inquiring position. This is what the scientist does. but he stops there. Hence the plaint of hidden philosophy. It welcomes the forward march of the scientist. It is not, like religion, afraid of him. Only it would urge him to rest at nothing short of a position from which he can affirm the ultimate truth or uncontradictable judgment. Such a position can belong only to the rigorous activity of pure reason put on its widest stretch, and is not to be disclosed by physical observation or laboratory experiment. The primitive standpoint is a necessity of day-to-day living. It may prove quite successful for practical as opposed to theoretical purposes and thus require no other sanction from the average man. It is generally based on the crude and naive reports of the five senses. The fact of these reports is there and everybody must accept it. The simpleton is satisfied with the face value of his fact and in his mental poverty refuses to go behind the actual experience. But both scientist and philosopher will accept it only tentatively and then proceed to question it for its meaning. Both perceived that it is essential to pass in thought beyond immediate experience into wider and deeper inquiry into the way in which the fact came into being. If popular thought were always right thought, instruction would not be required. If immediate impressions were sufficient to know the whole truth about anything, education would not be called in to correct them. And if men naturally perceived the meaning of the universe and of their own lives, the work of philosophy would be quite superfluous. Men are, in fact, born in original and native error. They win through to sound knowledge only by laboriously rectifying their common and spontaneous judgments. Yet popular abhorrence of mental effort is usually content with the easier view, ridden with numerous fallacies though it be, and often suspicious of the philosophers, although the latter's represents the long struggle and final victory of reason. Thus we arrive at the conclusion that there will always be two possible ways of looking at the world. The first standpoint is multiple and may include innumerable degrees of what is believed to be real or true, but it is always involved in what is technically called in logic the fallacy of simplicity. It may be described as being primitive, inferior, relative, ordinary, simple, practical, common sense, empirical, immediate, partial, finite, phenomenal, local, ignorant and obvious. The second viewpoint may be described as being absolute, ultimate, philosophic, unified, highest, noumenal, reflective, universal, true, full, unique, superior, final and hidden. We have already seen how science offends the common sense standpoint. Then how much more will the latter be offended by whatever takes up a stand which is higher even than that of science? This higher view is not only unquestionably necessary but happily possible. Philosophy alone provides it because it alone climbs to the very summit and refuses to limit itself to compartmentalism, but surveys the whole of existence, including the surveying mind itself. Philosophy seeks to fill the lack created through the compartmentalism of practical life and scientific research by taking the utmost care that no aspect of mental and material existence, the revelation of relativity however insignificant it be regarded by others, shall be omitted from its wide purview and unique coordination. Science can never complete its task alone. Its adventure is a grand one but it can come to no terminus. When it gets weary of this circle traveling it shall seek for respite, not by weakening into the soothing arms of mysticism but by rising into the arctic air of philosophy shall it find enduring peace. This vicious round of relativity has no outlet unless science has recourse to the help of the philosophic view. Two separate standpoints thus arise and bifurcate our view of nature. There can be only one ultimate truth and one final standpoint whose character will be both unalterable and invulnerable. The philosopher seeks to discover them and is satisfied with nothing less. The concept of the world which arises out of the utmost pure reflection is different from that which arises out of the first sensual impression. We must distinguish sharply between them. For the first is perfect whilst the second is premature. The first standpoint is that of the universe itself, the second is that of man. The first sees from the viewpoint of the whole universe and not merely from that of the knowledge of any particular man, hence it is absolute and true, whereas the second sees only anthropocentrically, hence always relatively. The changeover from the lower to the higher standpoint taken by the hidden teaching can come only after one climbs up the scaffolding of long experience of life, or after one struggles across the river of deep reflection about it. For it is the change from first love to final mating. It is often heralded when circumstances present hard problems which conflict with preconceived beliefs and perplex the unenslaved mind.